1095, thousands of European Christian warriors marched across Europe into Byzantium and then to the Middle East in a quest to claim the city of Jerusalem. What became known as the First Crusade precipitated unrestrained warfare and inspired both fervent religious raptures and unspeakable atrocities. After 4 years of savage battles, the journey ended in a ferocious fight in the Holy City where blood ran shin-deep in the streets. J. Rubenstein believes that the Crusade ushered in a new era in history and created our distinction of East and West. His latest book, Armies of Heaven, tells the story of these pivotal 4 years. It's published by Basic Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings J. Rubenstein to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I was surprised to see that one of the blurbs on your book cover was from Terry Jones. Now, I'm assuming that you use some unusual sources outside the typical medieval canon to research this book, but you didn't go to Monty Python and the Holy Grail for any inspiration, did you?
All medieval historians go to Monty Python for inspiration.
How accurate is that film?
A lot of medieval historians have maintained it's the most accurate movie ever made about the Middle Ages. That may be an exaggeration, but riding around looking for shrubberies made as much sense as anything else that ever happened then.
And this is already the Middle Ages. It's past what we used to call the Dark Ages?
It's past the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages are dark because there are so few sources available. And by the time you get to the end of the 11th century, people are writing more and books are surviving more.
The word crusade didn't appear until after the events in your book. When Pope Urban II issued a call to arms, what did he call it?
He called it a pilgrimage. Historians who wrote about it called it a path or even the motion. But now it took about 100 years to realize that they'd created a movement and they needed a name for it.
Wasn't Urban II one of two men who claimed to be pope at the time?
He was. The other one was named Paschal II and had been... No, I take that back. The other one was named Clement and he had been appointed by the emperor.
And he was in Rome and Urban was in... Was he in exile or just another part of Italy?
Urban had recently made it back into Rome, but then had left again. At the time of the Crusade, literally, they divided the Vatican between them, and Urban's men held a couple of towers, and Clement's men held the main church. And Crusaders went in to pray, and Clement's men threw rocks on their heads while they were praying.
But I'm assuming that Urban had more power because he called for this Crusade, and a lot of people answered the call.
Power was pretty evenly divided between them still, I think. Nobody was quite sure who was going to prevail. The fact that he called the crusade and won out meant eventually his side did prevail.
Why did he preach an expedition to reclaim Jerusalem?
That's the $60,000 question. Nobody's really sure why he did it.
And do we know what he said?
We don't. We have one sentence that is accurate from his sermon. Several people wrote about his sermon about 10 years after the fact, but they all wrote what they thought he ought to have said rather than what he actually said.
Do you think this was a way for him to solve the problems of his legitimacy?
I think in retrospect, it did that. It's hard for me to believe he was thinking that at the time just because it's such a harebrained idea, getting a bunch of poorly organized warriors together and sending them off to conquer Jerusalem.
Now, was this different than Alexander the Great going off to conquer foreign lands or Darius conquering foreign lands?
I think it was different because there was no central paymaster. There was no organized army. It was just a lot of powerful and semi-powerful people getting together and thinking, for the sake of religion, we're going to do this.
And it was totally driven by religious fervor?
I'm sure there were some people who had other motives in mind, and maybe Urban II did as well, but for the most part, yeah, religious fervor was the driving force.
Don't some people say that the Crusades were a defensive war, that the West was taking back what had been taken from it?
A lot of people have said that recently. To me, it's a really hard argument to wrap my head around and take seriously. Jerusalem had been a Muslim city, I think, for about 450 years by the time of the First Crusade. So it's not as if this was a sudden response.
Well, had it ever been a Christian area? The Jews had been forced out in the diaspora. Mm-hmm. Rome eventually left and...
Yeah, the Jews had been forced out about 130, and Rome at that time leveled the whole city and rebuilt a small outpost and called it Aelia Capitolina. It only became a Christian city in 325 after Constantine converted to Christianity. stayed that way for about three centuries, and then Islam took over.
And had been there a lot longer, had a much greater claim to possession. Did Christians feel that they had lost something, or was that an argument here?
That was an argument that was made. Christians, when they made an argument, said that Muslims were actually polluting and corrupting the city. It was like they were a contagion that had to be cleaned out. And they only seem to have come to this opinion within around 1095.
But they didn't call them Muslims. They called them Saracens.
They called them Saracens.
What does the word mean? It's kind of fallen into disuse.
Yeah, it shows up in French cooking still, I think, and that's about it. Saracen is a tribal word that dates back before Islam. It became associated with Muslims, I think, about the 7th century, and by the 1000s, that was all anybody called them. They developed a mythological etymology to describe it. They decided that Muslims were descendants of Hagar, the serving woman of Sarah who had Ishmael with Isaac, but they were embarrassed about it and they wanted to be descended from Abraham's real wife, Sarah, so they called themselves Saracen.
And how was the religion of the Saracens understood by the Crusaders?
Very vaguely at best. I think some of them had some knowledge of it but did not want to admit they did. Saracens were described in epic poetry as idol worshippers. They worshipped three gods named Muhammad, Apollo, and Termagant. They just attached onto Muslims anything that was the opposite of Christianity and made them sound bad.
And was that what the Song of Roland said?
That's what the Song of Roland said, exactly.
What do you mean when you say that whenever Christians wanted to understand or explain Islam, they thought about themselves and the end of the days?
By saying they thought about themselves, I mean they thought about what is Christianity, what am I, and then they tried to imagine the opposite. When I say the end of days, I'm thinking that they were situating Muslims within the narrative of the apocalypse.
Well, right now there are people who, Christians, who see this as the place of the apocalypse, which is becoming any day now. Was there a similar thought at that time?
I think a lot of the crusading army thought the apocalypse was at hand, and I would even go so far as to say after they conquered Jerusalem in 1099, they thought the apocalypse had just happened.
Well, there was also a strong sense of apocalypse into the beginning of the millennium, wasn't there? Many people thought that the world would end in the year 1000.
Historians debate about that a lot, but there was definitely in the south of France a strong sense of that. They reacted in similar ways to the Crusaders, which is to say when they felt the apocalypse was coming, they started to persecute Jews.
Why was there this emphasis on capturing a physical place? Didn't Jesus say, "My kingdom is not of this world"? And didn't Christianity offer an afterlife?
That's another question that I wrestle with a lot. I think that for the previous several hundred years, Christians had learned to think of Jerusalem as a metaphor, if you will. It was a place in the heart, as Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world." But as the 11th century wore on, Christians started to think more and more about physical places. And for whatever reason, they felt like, we want the physical place back. This was the time when the cult of relics was at its height, when people worshipped saints' bones, when the highest expression of spirituality was to travel to a shrine and whisper into the dead ear of the saint, thinking that the saint could then relay it to heaven. Christianity was a very tangible, physical thing.
My guess is Jay Rubenstein has written about the Middle Ages in the past. His latest book is Armies of Heaven, The First Crusade and the Quest for Apocalypse. It is published by Basic Books. So why was this call to arms embraced the way it was? Who was responding?
The people who responded most enthusiastically, ironically, had not heard the Pope preach. I think a lot of them were responding to a person who I've characterized as a crackpot hermit named Peter. He seemed to be preaching a much more explosive apocalyptic message. He carried around a scroll, which he said was a letter that had fallen into his hands from heaven. The people who responded were dukes and counts, a lot of them in the north of France, some of them in Lotharingia, the area that we fought two world wars over. And then also there was a large contingent from Provence in what is today the south of France.
So he put together his own army?
Who's that?
Peter the Hermit.
Peter the Hermit. He did actually put together his own army that left in advance of the Pope's armies. It was wiped out near Constantinople.
So it was wiped out before it ever got to Jerusalem.
Yes.
What were they doing in Constantinople?
Everybody seemed to know to rendezvous at Constantinople. It's a long march, and as I said, everybody was paying their own way. So Constantinople was the last strong Christian outpost, and it was also very rich. So people were hoping to get fed and replenish their supplies.
But it represented a competing Christian church, didn't it?
It did. One of the reasons why Urban II preached the First Crusade, we think, is that the emperor of Constantinople, Alexius, wrote to him and asked for help. He wrote to ask for help because the Seljuk Turks had taken over Sunni Islam from Baghdad, and they were expanding toward Constantinople. So he needed an army of mercenaries, and he thought the Pope could help him get that. The Pope, from his perspective, knew that the Catholics and the Greek Orthodox Church had split with apparent permanency in 1054, and he was hoping to create some sort of rapprochement between the two faiths.
So Peter the Hermit's army was wiped out by a battle with Muslims?
They were, by the people who had control of Nicaea. The leader was named Kilij Arslan.
Now, why I understand that people might feel a religious fervor and go off to war, but they were pretty much leaving everything that they owned behind. And did they have any idea of how long this might take?
I can't think they had any idea how long it would take or how difficult it would be. The fact that, as you say, they were leaving everything they owned behind, and they were leaving it at great risk because this was a very violent society in which people fought for property constantly. That's what makes people think it has to be about religion rather than economics. This is just an economic loser idea to go to Jerusalem.
There were many stories of miracles that occurred over the course of the First Crusade. What were some of the first signs?
The signs started before the crusade began, apparently. People saw the images in the clouds of two horsemen clashing.
So that came from the Book of Revelation.
That came from the Book of Revelation, although they elaborated on it. In case you missed the subtlety, one of the riders carried a cross and beat the other one over the head with it. People miraculously received tattoos on their bodies. I suspect that was faked, and I think my readers might pick up on my suspicion when I describe those as well.
And then there was an eclipse?
There were eclipses. There were meteor showers. There was a dramatic eclipse of the moon in February of 1096 when some Parisian knights were trying to decide whether to go, and that seems to have settled the issue for them, that God was speaking through the moon. Yes, we have to go to Jerusalem.
Who were leading these armies? Was it mostly European nobility?
Mostly European nobility, yes.
And were they looking for some kind of spiritual reward, or were they hoping to come back with a lot of booty?
I think some of the leadership probably were hoping to come back with booty. Some of them, like Robert of Normandy, were in real political trouble. He was William the Conqueror's son, and he was about to lose his duchy to his brother, and this was a way out. And some of them, I think, were just going for religious fervor.
Now, when the Peter the Hermit's army was defeated at Nicaea, did that have much of an impact on the Greek Empire, the Byzantium?
That didn't have any impact on Byzantium. I think it was probably a depressing thing for the crusaders to arrive and find so many unburied headless corpses. But as far as the Byzantine Empire was concerned, they were hoping for 5,000 crack mercenaries, probably at best. What they got were 100,000 or more religious fanatics, and I don't think that they knew what to do with Peter's army.
And then there was a truce after the battle. And the crusaders were really angry about that as well.
After the crusaders captured Nicaea, they weren't happy with the truce that was drawn up because they didn't get to plunder the city.
Well, they lost.
They lost the city back to Alexius. From the leader's perspective and from Alexius's perspective, I think it had gone just as they had hoped. From the soldier's perspective, the way you pay the way is plunder the cities you conquer.
So did they move on to Jerusalem, or did most of them just return home?
They moved on. I don't think there was a lot of desertion after Nicaea. They moved on, and the next major stop was Antioch.
And that battle uh, uh, Was Antioch well defended?
Antioch was very well defended. The Crusaders estimated, the eyewitness accounts estimated that it had 360 towers around the wall. I think that was an exaggeration, but the siege lasted over 8 months.
And what was the significance of Antioch?
From a Christian perspective, Antioch is the city where Christianity began. According to the Book of Acts, it's the first place where the word Christian was used. I think from a political perspective, it was an important outpost of the Byzantine Empire. It had only recently been captured by the Seljuk Turks, so it was of great military significance. I think some of the Crusaders weren't that happy that they were concentrating on Antioch so much and not just getting on to Jerusalem.
There were incredible atrocities in these battles. Prisoners were beheaded.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the continuing motifs of horror in your book is the dismembering of bodies, the carrying of hearts tied to saddles as trophies.
Oh.
Was this typical of the behavior of the time?
Heads tied to saddles as trophies rather than hearts, but it was not typical of the behavior of the time. A lot of my colleagues have tried to minimize the level of horror by saying, well, these were just the rules of war. It was understood that if you took the city violently through military conquest, everybody's life was forfeit. If they surrendered, then you reach some accommodation. That may have been the understood rules of war, but they were never applied in Europe. This was a new experience of warfare for all of the soldiers.
Because just a little while before, William the Conqueror won the Battle of Hastings. He didn't do this kind of thing.
Hastings was a huge, violent battle, but when it was over, and William the Conqueror saw to the honorable burial of all of his adversaries, except for King Harold. He wanted to have him buried in secret.
Do you think it's also because the enemy had been demonized?
And demonized quite literally. One of the historians described Saracens as the limbs of demons. When people wrote about Muhammad, they would say, if you want to understand Muhammad, just think about Christ and do the opposite. He is the anti-Christ in the way that Muslims are the anti-Christians, and I think this morphed into anti-Christ as we think of it, the great villain of the Book of Revelation.
As an aside, one of the leaders of the crusade, Baldwin of Bologna, goes off to Syria. Why that diversion?
He went off to, I think Baldwin was somebody who was not as religiously fervent as the other crusaders. He had broken off from the army originally and traveled around Tarsus, and he had learned the political layout of the land. I think he went off on his own and eventually conquered Edessa because he saw that was where his fortune would be, and he had had a falling out with a couple of the major leaders in the army.
Now, the alliances aren't always predictable. The Egyptians came to the aid of the Franks, didn't they?
They discussed coming to their aid. The Egyptians had held Jerusalem until about, I believe it's 1078, and then they had lost it to the Seljuk Turks. So they wanted Jerusalem back, and they were hoping they could work with the Frankish Christians. The Franks negotiated with the Egyptians for a while, but actually during the siege of Antioch, Egypt got Jerusalem back.
And you say that it was during the siege of Antioch that the crusade became a full-fledged holy war.
That's right. I say that because, in part because Antioch was the first full massacre. When the Crusaders got into the city, they killed anyone they came across.
And they weren't thinking about all of the things Jesus had said about killing people?
No.
Isn't this rather unchristian behavior?
That would seem to be the case. Jesus does say things in the Bible about, you know, go get your sword, and if you're a soldier, accept your wages, and I will come back bearing the sword. I'm paraphrasing a bit there. So there are some militant passages in the gospel. From the Crusader perspective, they were trying to bring about the end of the world. They were trying to bring about the sort of culmination of the ages, which would lead to an age of peace. So they might see what they were doing as peaceful on some level.
My guest is Jay Rubenstein. His latest book, Armies of Heaven, The First Crusade and the Quest for Apocalypse, is published by Basic Books. But then they didn't move on to Jerusalem after Antioch. Why?
They didn't move on to Jerusalem in part because I think the army was worn out after such a long siege.
But it was just 10 days' march from Jerusalem.
May have been a bit longer than that, but they were within striking distance. And a lot of the ordinary soldiers wanted to go on to Jerusalem. The leaders, however, wanted to rest up, and they also were feuding about who had control of Antioch.
And then things even went wilder. This was when some of the armies, people in the army turned to cannibalism.
Yeah, this was the really dark time of the Crusade. You were asking earlier if people deserted after Nicaea. They didn't, but after the siege of Mara, a lot of people did grow disillusioned, and it seems to have been because there was widespread cannibalism of Muslim bodies by the Franks, either during the siege or after, I think, during the siege.
Because there wasn't enough meat or food available, or because they were making some other kind of point?
There are two explanations. One is there wasn't enough meat available. The other is they wanted to scare the enemy to death. One of the accounts written by somebody who had talked to actual cannibals said that they put the bodies on spits, roasted them in front of the city so that the defenders could see what was happening.
What was the Holy Lance of Antioch?
The Holy Lance of Antioch was thought to be the lance with which the Roman soldier Longinus pierced the side of Christ. It was discovered during the siege, and I think you have to put discovered in ironic quotation marks, by a poor Provençal visionary named Peter Bartholomew.
And he came into possession of it, but then he died.
He did die. People started to doubt the authenticity of the lance about 8 months after it was discovered, and in April he was put through an ordeal by fire.
An auto de fe.
Something like that. He had to walk through a literal hall of fire, corridor of fire, carrying the lance with him. They started to doubt him, I think, because he had continued to have visions after the lance had been discovered, and in the last one, he said that Christ had told him to force the army along, and he should create a violent purge in which all of the people who didn't want to go straight to Jerusalem were killed.
Were people back in Europe aware of what was going on?
They were following it as best they could. There were some crusaders and crusade leaders were sending letters back to Europe to describe what had happened. One writer who was in Europe at the time of the Crusade recalled seeing a lot of strange meteorological activity one evening in February 1098, and he said everybody got together and said, they're fighting in the east now.
So they finally go to Jerusalem.
Jerusalem. They arrive at Jerusalem in May of 1099, and it's a six-week siege. They try to capture the city with a quick opening attack, and they've been assured by a hermit, not Peter, but another one, this will work. It doesn't work. They spend another month building siege equipment, and on July 15th, they break into the city and, over the course of 2 days, kill everyone who's left in it.
It was a difficult siege, but not as difficult as Antioch?
Not as difficult as Antioch. Jerusalem wasn't as well defended. It had been captured. It had changed hands a couple of times already within the last 20 years, including just the year before. So it was more imminently takeable than Antioch was. They were also under a time limit because if they didn't capture Jerusalem, they were likely to get crushed in front of the city walls by a relief force out of Egypt.
Now, you've described this whole thing as a turning point in history. There were other crusades. Why is this one special?
Well, it's special, first of all, because it was the first. It's special as well because, as much as you can use this word in connection with something like the Crusade, it succeeded. They captured Jerusalem. And
how long did they hold on to it?
They held on to it for nearly 100 years. It fell in 1187. It was special as well because in Europe, when people learned what had happened, there was a great outpouring of celebration and a great sense of achievement. This is something that we have accomplished as a culture.
As Christians.
And also, they use this term fairly explicitly as Westerners. Look at what we Westerners have done in the East.
So this creates a concept of Christianity as a geography.
Exactly. That's a very nice way of phrasing it. I think it helps to solidify geographically a word which is coming into a lot more common parlance at that time, which is Christendom.
Well, hey, we still talk about this conflict between the East and the West.
We do. I suspect we have inherited that vocabulary from the Crusade era.
But is it an exaggeration to say that this is the time of the birth of the modern world?
It's always an exaggeration to say this is the time when the modern world was born. The modern world is born out of a lot of circumstances, but this is one of those moments when a lot of factors came together that advanced us along the path to modernity.
You say it's difficult to ignore resonances between the story of a Western army attacking a little understood Eastern culture, believing itself to be a liberator of the cities it conquered, trusting that God was on its side, anxious and hopeful that its exertions would remake the world. This sounds like some of the stuff we've heard more recently when President Bush used the word crusade. It really didn't do very, you know, it caused a lot of
They decided to rethink that one after he said it.
And then people like Ann Coulter, now we realize she can be out of control, she once suggested that we invade all of the Middle East and Christianize everyone.
Mm-hmm. That was pretty much straightforward crusading language. One of the reasons why we have to keep rewriting history is the meanings change to us, or we're able to see new meanings in them as time goes on. And I don't think post-9/11, post-war on terror, you can write the same crusade history that you did before.
How many crusades were there in all?
Crusading became sort of a way of life, but there are 8 numbered ones.
Some of them actually took place in Europe, didn't they?
None of the numbered ones did. The Fourth Crusade infamously didn't get past Constantinople. That resulted in the Christians conquering Constantinople and turning the Greek Empire Latin for a time.
And then that eventually fell to the Muslims.
Constantinople fell back to the Greeks in 1261, and about 200 years later it fell to the Muslims.
And so what happened? So each one of these crusades was to recapture Jerusalem, which had been taken back?
The second crusade was to recapture Edessa, the city founded by that fellow Baldwin we were talking about earlier, the crusader state.
Odessa on the Black Sea?
Edessa, which is in Syria today. That's actually in Turkey today.
Uh-huh.
And by the time the crusaders got there, the city had been pretty much destroyed. They didn't know what to do, so they lay siege to Damascus and after a week gave up and went home.
So this means a lot of different popes are sending people out to join the crusades. Did they always have a religious significance, or were they seen at different times as opportunities for advancement, to become rich and the like?
They were always framed as having a religious message, but I think as time went on and people knew it was going to happen more, well, at that point you could adopt all sorts of motives. There's a great moment in one of the Fourth Crusade narratives where a soldier's traveling with one army and he sees another army and says, "I'm going with them, I think they'll get rich."
But also, weren't people told that if they joined the crusade, then all of their sins would be forgiven, an invitation for every thug to participate in a holy war?
Very nicely put, every thug. The first promise of a crusade indulgence by Pope Urban was fairly carefully worded. You would get forgiveness for sins you had committed beforehand and had confessed. This grew up during the course of the crusade into the idea that, according to some people, if you go on crusade and you come back alive, then you have a free ticket to go to heaven and can do whatever you want with the rest of your life.
But you also point out that this is the beginning of the development of the concept of individualism.
I think I try to hint at that, but that's the sort of bold claim I would never want to make.
But, you know, when we talk about the sources of the Renaissance, it takes a long time for the Renaissance to actually develop. But it's because also people change their idea of our place in the universe. And here are these people who are also going out and seeing a world that they couldn't have seen otherwise, having all sorts of – the same way that when the American military went into Europe in World War I and World War II, it changed life back home.
Yeah, I think the 12th century has been described as the age of the discovery of the individual. We have a hard time figuring out exactly what that means. But I think on one level, the level you describe, the eyes of these Europeans are open to a much wider world, a much more complex and wealthier world than they're used to. On another level, I think the crusade indulgence helped people discover the individual because you really had to think about your sins. You really had to think about what you had done. And I think people had to learn to evaluate character because of the First Crusade, which is a new idea in the Middle Ages.
Jay Rubenstein's latest book is Armies of Heaven, The First Crusade and the Quest for Apocalypse. It is published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.